stern against the unbelievers here means being hard, firm, and unflinching or impenetrable vis-a-vis the unbelievers. Do not let their influence find its way into your society. If the influence of an enemy, a foreign power, or an ill-wisher exists, this means that you have no authority of your own. The rest of this ayah concerns relationships between people in society and is an invitation to kindness, to affection, sincerity, and cordiality between individuals in society. This being merciful and kind amongst themselves, as the Holy Quran says, is also one of these treasures. Life in society should be with kindness, with magnanimity, with generosity, and such things. Commenting further, the leader said, "We must avoid transgressors and the evildoers of this world. We must not associate with them. Avoid the taghut, or tyrants, as the Holy Quran says." The Quran teaches us to avoid the tyrants. This is one of the treasures that can help us move our lives in the right direction. Ayatollah Khamenei further stressed, "There are thousands of precious treasures like this in the noble Quran, the teachings of Islam, and in the appointment of the Holy Prophet. This appointment of the Prophet has given us all of these blessings." Commenting further, Ayatollah Khamenei said, "Some of us Muslims are not even aware of these treasures. Some of us deny these treasures and are ungrateful for these great divine gifts. Some of us take pride in them, but we do not act in accordance with them. Unfortunately, that is how it is. And what is the outcome of this? The outcome is that the Islamic world becomes divided, it lags behind, and it becomes weak both in terms of knowledge and action. This is the outcome. And at one period of time, Muslims were able to build the greatest civilization in the world of their time by partially and not even fully acting in accordance with these bezels of wisdom. In the 3rd and 4th centuries after the migration of the Muslims, there was no other government, no other power or nation on earth that was as advanced as the Islamic civilization. This is why we know that they only partially acted in accordance with these bezels of wisdom back then. The people who were ruling were not good people. They were by no means perfect or suitable as rulers. But even so, they managed to achieve the most advanced civilization of their time." The leader added, "We can eliminate the weaknesses that exist in the Islamic world by referring to these treasures that have been gifted to us due to the appointment of the Holy Prophet. The treasures relating to the Islamic teachings and relating to Islamic rulings and those related to Islamic ethics." Turning to the issue of occupied Palestine, Ayatollah Khamenei said, "One matter is the Palestinian issue, which is once again one of the most important issues of today. A nation is completely under the control of some savage, wicked, evil people. They're not normal people, and the Islamic world is simply watching. The Palestinian people, that is those who have remained in Palestine and have not been forced out of their homeland, are being oppressed every day, in their own land, in their own homes. The Zionists have destroyed a corner and build Zionist settlements every day before our very eyes. All these Islamic governments, with all the wealth that exists in the Islamic world and with all the capabilities of the Islamic world, are watching this happen. For many years, a nation is being oppressed like this before our very eyes. This has harmed the Islamic world itself. In other words, Islamic governments and countries have remained silent in the face of this kind of aggression, which is aggression against themselves and the Islamic nation. In some cases, especially recently, they have unfortunately gone along with the Zionist regime. These countries have become weakened as well. This is the situation that we are in today. The world's most advanced countries, the world powers, feel that they have the right to interfere in the affairs of Islamic countries. They openly interfere in our domestic affairs. The United States in one way, and France in another way. Each one interferes in the affairs of Islamic countries in a certain way, and they feel as if they have the right to do so. They can't even manage their own countries. They have not been able to solve their own problems, and yet they feel as if they have the right to openly interfere in the internal affairs of Islamic countries. Well, this demonstrates the weaknesses of the Islamic world and the weakness of Islamic governments due to neglecting the issue of Palestine. In the case of Palestine, if Islamic governments had stood firm and resisted from the very beginning, the situation in our region in West Asia today would have been very different. Today, we would have been much stronger, more united, and in many ways have been better. Back then, the well-wishers such as the great religious scholars of Najaf wrote letters and gave their opinions and delivered sermons on the issue of occupied Palestine and the usurpation of Palestine. Some sympathetic individuals who truly cared did the same. An Arabic poet stated, "If you lose Palestine, you will live a life that is full of struggles and pains." His poem is true. If you abandon Palestine, you will suffer from pain, suffering and the like over a long period of time. In further comments, the leader said, "Today, the Islamic Republic of Iran openly expresses what is in the hearts of the oppressed Palestinian people. We do not care what others think. We state the truth in a loud voice. We support and defend the oppressed Palestinians. We will defend the Palestinian nation in whatever way we can. This has caused the enemies to focus on spreading Islamophobia. And those who have the obligation to help Palestine at least as much as we have helped them, they actually cooperate with the enemies about Iranophobia. The solution to all these problems is to return to Islam, the unity of Islamic nations, empathy between Islamic nations, and true cooperation between Islamic governments. We need to truly cooperate and empathize with each other. All parts of the Islamic Ummah need to cooperate with each other. Problems always surface. If you take a look at the devastating earthquakes that recently affected Syria and Turkey, well, that was a tragic event. This is something that is related to all Muslims. That is to say, every one of us should truly feel pained and saddened by such events." In concluding remarks, the leader said, "I hope that Almighty God will help all of us to truly make use of the appointment of Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny, to prophethood and to make the Mab'as of the Holy Prophet a true aid for the Islamic world."
Eye on Islam.
Assalamu alaikum, peace be upon you, and welcome to Eye on Islam, the show where we look at stories through an Islamic lens. Each week, we'll take a look at trending news, and this week we're looking at historical stories which have a direct relevance to the religion of Islam, and we'll break it down from a Muslim perspective. Today, we're going to celebrate one of the golden ages of Islamic history, the 800-year period the Muslims ruled over what is modern-day Spain and Portugal. The anniversary of the end of that glorious period falls in the month of January, which is a great opportunity for Muslims to reflect on what made Muslim Spain, or Al-Andalus, so great.
In January 1492, the last Muslim kingdom of Al-Andalus, better known as Muslim Spain, fell to the Catholic monarchs, putting an end to 800 years of glorious Islamic civilization. The Muslim presence in the Iberian Peninsula was a time when religious tolerance, sophisticated scholarship, glorious architecture, and a superior lifestyle prevailed. Muslim Spain is now best known by the glories of its architecture, such as the Alhambra Palace in Granada, one of Europe's most visited monuments. But it was perhaps the Cordoba Caliphate from the 8th to 11th centuries which personified Al-Andalus at its height, with Muslims, Jews, and Christians all intermingling and flourishing under Muslim rule. By the 15th century, the Christians had begun to squeeze the Muslims. But the real impetus for the fall of Granada was when Ferdinand of Aragon and Isabella of Castile married to unite the two largest Christian kingdoms. These monarchs had a vision of a uniquely Catholic nation. Around 100,000 Muslims were subsequently killed or enslaved, and 200,000 fled. Later, a decree would be ordered, forcing those who remained to convert to Christianity on pain of death. The Catholic monarchs also passed a decree expelling all Jews or forcing them to convert, again on pain of death.
Well, later on in the show, we'll be talking to two experts on Islamic Spain. But first, joining us in the studio today is Roshan Mohammed Saleh, who is the editor of the Muslim news website Five Pillars. Roshan is a very frequent visitor to the historic Muslim areas of modern-day Spain and has kindly agreed to share his experiences with us today. Roshan, welcome to the show. It's great to have you on, as always. Just tell me, what's your view of Islamic Spain? Tell me about your experiences there.
Well, I've been there about 10 times over the years, and the last time was only about a month and a half ago. And I just think it's the most beautiful part of Europe. I think, and especially if you're a Muslim and you're interested in Islamic history, like every Muslim should be, then Andalusia in the southern part of Spain, where the Muslim influence is the strongest, is the place to go. And I could recommend a few places, like Granada is the obvious place with the Alhambra Palace, which is probably the most beautiful monument in Europe. It's just an amazing place, a fortress and several palaces. Then there's the Mesquita or the mosque, the Grand Mosque of Cordoba, which is literally one of the most beautiful mosques in the whole world. And even Masjid al-Nabawi in Medina, it's modeled on the Mesquita in Cordoba, the famous arches. And there are other, you know, beautiful places like there's a fortress in Malaga, there's a Muslim tower in Seville. So it's literally, and the landscape will remind lots of Muslims of North Africa as well, Morocco, Algeria, Tunisia, you know, mountainous olive trees everywhere. It's just a really beautiful place.
Now, I'm pretty embarrassed to say I haven't been yet, unfortunately.
Okay,
I must go. But interesting enough, you've written about the sadness you feel when you visit this region as well. Could you explain that to
me? Yeah, so it's kind of, I always have mixed feelings because I'm really happy to be there. But when you visit some of these Muslim monuments, you know, they've been desecrated by the Christians. After the fall of Granada in 1492, the Catholic monarchs in particular, they had this policy of desecrating Qurans and just generally denigrating Muslim culture. So
forced
the Alhambra...
Forced conversions.
Yeah, exactly. And the Alhambra, for example, they built a kind of a palace, a Christian-style palace right in the middle of the Alhambra, which looks really incongruous next to the Muslim architecture. They did the same thing in the Grand Mosque of Cordoba. They put a Christian cathedral right in the middle of that mosque. So they basically vandalized it. And, you know, when you go to these places, you can't pray, for example, if you try to pray as a Muslim, even though there's a mihrab there, you know, direction of the prayer, you know, you're ready to pray, but they won't let you pray. They'll physically stop you from praying. You could get arrested if you pray. So it's just a reminder of what we lost. And the fact is that we're not allowed to celebrate it properly in modern day Muslim Spain. Spain, rather.
Yes, it's interesting you mention those points, because there surely are some Muslims still left in Spain. What's the community like there?
Limited. There's a bit of immigration, kind of like, menial labour from places like Morocco especially, but, you know, Tunisia and other places in North Africa and, you know, sub-Saharan Africa as well. But the Muslim presence in Spain is less than it would be in other European countries, like the UK, for example, where we have 4 million plus Muslims, France, where there's 6 million plus Muslims. It's much less. I think it's well under a million in Spain. And that's because there's been a deliberate policy of, kind of keeping the Muslim presence in Spain quite small. Mosques, for example, regularly are denied building permits. There are a few mosques now, but there aren't many mosques. But still, you can see the vestiges of Muslim Spain, and even in the faces of the people, because lots of Spaniards, Christian Spaniards, were originally Arabs, and they have Arab blood in them. Even the Spanish language has lots of Arabic words. The food, and it permeates every aspect of life, but sometimes you have to look for it.
Yes, and I know that there are still place names which originate from the Arabic language.
Absolutely.
That haven't changed, that type of thing. And I wonder, very briefly, Roshan, Islamophobia is a European-wide phenomena, it's a problem across the board. But in Spain, would you say that it's worse because of this issue? They're trying to stamp out Muslim culture?
Absolutely. They were doing that because, you know, the policy once 1492 happened, it was eradication of Islam. And that has served as a blueprint for modern societies. France is going down that route in many ways, not physical extermination, but extermination of a religion, and lots of European societies. So even the influence of, you know, the Spanish Inquisition, for example, it permeates into modern life even today.
Well, Roshan, we are going to come back to you later on in the show, if I'm not mistaken. But for the time being, I want to move on and take a look at what people on social media have been saying about the anniversary of Al-Andalus and its fall in modern-day Spain.
Twitter has become awash with opinions regarding the legacy of Islamic Spain. Muslims hold Al-Andalus in high regard and praise the period as a shining example of an Islamic region leading in tolerance and enlightenment.
One of the most understudied pieces of human history, the impact this caliphate had on knowledge building alone is tremendous to today's modern society. May this serve as a reminder for all, regardless of religion or culture, to appreciate Muslim contributions to history. Alhamdulillah, since its arrival, Islam has still been there longer than it hasn't. May bring back the Nur that illuminated Europe, and by extension, the world. Ameen.
Some non-Muslims use the occasion to troll Muslims and praise the collapse of Islamic rule in the Iberian Peninsula.
People of Spain are so happy they drove the invaders back to where they belonged. Spain grew to be a great nation and an empire. They helped greatly to push back the Ottomans and keep them away from total defeat of Europe.
While other Muslims believe lessons should be learned about Muslims and their trust for the un-Islamic world.
It's what happens when you sit on your laurels and you're not alerted to the plots of the disbelievers. You have to never trust the disbelievers and must be permanently on high alert to defend yourself and spread your cause. Today again, we are trusting them whilst they plot our destruction. Many of the traits for which modern US prides itself comes from Muslim Spain, who achieved these traits first. Diplomacy, free trade, open borders, techniques of academic research, anthropology, fashion, algorithms, medicine, hospitals, etc. But the only thing the West associates us with is terrorism.
Well, I'm honoured to declare that we have another guest joining us now to add to this discussion, Dr. Uthman Latif, a celebrated Muslim author, a renowned historian, teacher and lecturer based here in Britain. Assalamu alaikum, Doctor. Thank you so much for joining us on the show. Now, firstly, just start off by telling us why you think Islamic Spain was so great in your view.
I think for a few reasons. One, because Spain is recognised as Al-Andalus. In fact, that period is called by historians as a convivencia, as the coexistence between Muslims, Jews, and Christians, an unparalleled kind of moment in human history where Jews, Christians, and Muslims could thrive under Islamic rule in Islamic Spain. So we have, of course, a great kind of legacy of achievement under great rulers like Abdurrahman III, Al-Hakam II, the building of schools, of universities, of hospitals, of mosques, of makatib, of all of these things. But I think that that period, in fact, is very unique in human history because it represents kind of like you might call a golden age of civilization in Islam, but also, in fact, in Judaism. It's also seen as a golden age of Judaism. So, even for Christians, it's seen as a very great moment in their history.
Now, one of the aspects praised by both Muslim and even non-Muslim historians as well was the overall theme of tolerance, particularly towards religious minorities under Muslim rule, like Jews, for example, and the Christians too. But was it really as harmonious as it's made out by some?
Well, society, in fact, is in constant flux. There's never going to be a totality of anything. You're going to find good moments and also difficult moments as well. But remember, of course, when the Muslims arrived in 711, the Jews were facing a lot of persecution from the Catholic Christians. You had the Fourth Council of Toledo, and Jews were forced into baptism, forced conversions, expulsion from the land. And Zain Zohar, a Jewish academic, says that when the Muslims crossed the Straits of Gibraltar, they welcomed Muslims as liberators from Christian persecution. And that's kind of a standard narrative, and in fact, not just to do with Spain, but also in Jerusalem and also elsewhere as well. The Maghreb after the Inquisition as well. That Muslims have always been kind of seen as champions of justice, you know, for other people. So therefore, Spain kind of, I think, is representative of that.
Now, during this period, Europe is often referred to as going through a dark age in its history. Muslim Spain, of course, was going through a period of enlightenment. What kind of role did Muslim Spain have on dark age Europe?
We have a kind of a juxtaposition, in fact, in historical terms and cultural social terms, because what the Muslims are doing, in fact, in Spain at that time of that darkness in European history is enlightening the world. We have the beginning, in fact, of the seeds of the Renaissance of Western Europe, because Spain, of course, is in Europe. And we have, like I mentioned, the thriving of the culture of arts, of science, of botany. Seville, in fact, was known as a center of botany. Abu Bakr al-Ubaidi, Ibn al-Awwam al-Ishbili, very famous names, al-Ghafiqi, Ibn al-Baytar, Ibn Zuhr, Ibn Zawar, you know, very famous names, people excelling, in fact, in sciences, in geology, in geography, in mathematics, in astronomy. And then, of course, you have the beginning of taking these knowledges back to Europe, like from people like Petrus Alfonsi, for example, Michael Scott, who learned with the Muslims in Al-Andalus, in the schools of Toledo of Cordoba, and then took that knowledge back to Western Europe and began to educate the Europeans and their nobility about what the Muslims are learning, in fact, of these great sciences. And then, of course, they took it back, they enhanced it. That became the beginning of their renaissance in Western Europe.
Now, Doctor, a final question. What can we, the Muslim Ummah, learn? What lessons can we take from this period in Islamic history?
Well, I think one of the interesting things is you have this Imam Ar-Rundi writes a poem after the fall of Seville, 1248, I think it was. And he begins his poem by saying, لِكُلِّ شَيْنِ ذَاتْ مَتَمَ نُقْصَانْ فَلَا تُغُرُّ بِالطَيْبِ الْعَيْشِ يَا إِنسَانْ فَأَيْنَ الْمُلُوكُ ذُوِ التِّجَانِ مِنْ يَمَنٍ وَأَيْنَ مَحَزُ قَارُونَ مِنْ ذَهَبٍ وَأَيْنَ عَدْ وَثَمُودُ. He's asking, like, he says, everything that reaches its apex, its pinnacle, will have a defect and a fault. Nothing is, the dunya, the world we live in, isn't supposed to, in fact, to be perfect. And he says that, where are the kingdoms of Ad and Thamud? Where is Qarun and his treasures? Where is Qurtuba? He says, upon all of them came an affair. And it's as if, death came to all of them, and it's as if they didn't exist there in the first place. And that's a lesson, in fact. Every rule is temporal, is limited by vulnerability, by time. And so no one holds the keys of power forever. It's a lesson, in fact. I was in one of the trips I had to Spain. We visited the other city that was built outside Cordoba called the Medina of Zahra. Built after, it was named after the wife, I think, of Abdurrahman III. And 10% of it is excavated in the land from 1910 onward. That was the most glorious city. In fact, his diplomat was Jewish, Shasta ibn Shafud, and he would invite other kings and nobles to London to see the splendor of Islamic Spain. But the city is simply a loss, is a sign for us. And so I think that you look at two or three fundamental things. One, of course, is that having too much of the world isn't always a good thing, the dunya, and they had too much of the world. And all these examples in the Quran about the positive and negative kingdoms, like, for example, Suleiman was a good king, Dhul Qarnayn, a good king, but Qarun and Fir'aun were bad kings. And about the way that they appreciate and approach temporal power. The second thing, of course, is the difficulty of division. Once you divide, you become weak. Allah in the Quran, of course, is reminding the people, don't differ and argue, because when you're divided, and that's weakness. And that's what happens. So dunya, one thing, vision, of course, is the other thing. And both of these, I think, affected the Muslims of Al-Andalus and
unfortunately, Doctor, I have to end our discussion there for the time being. But thank you very much. We did appear to have some signal issues towards the end, but you passed on your points very, very well. And I think we learned a lot from that discussion. Well, earlier on, we also spoke to Muslim historian Asim Akil, who's also known as Tariq Trekker on YouTube. Tariq Trekker has filmed and presented an online history of Al-Andalus, which is available for all to see on his YouTube channel. We spoke about what happened to Muslim Spain after its tragic end.
I think the phenomenon of Islamic Spain known as Al-Andalus is great for many reasons. Number one, it can represent kind of like a lost paradise. It was a place where, or the first place in Europe where three religions lived together in peace for centuries, way before what we have in Europe today. I can remember listening to one historian on the topic say that the three religions, Judaism, Christianity, and Islam, the people of these religions all had the same culture, which when you think about it, is very different to what we see today in the Western world. So it was very unique. Spain is a modern day conception which comes into being after 1492. Prior to that, there was the Iberian Peninsula with a whole mix of ethnicities who would come in, whether it be Goths or Vandals or Greeks or Latin people, and eventually Berbers and Arabs. And the idea that it was a conquest, you can argue that it was a conquest. There are certain narratives as well that the Muslims were actually invited in by Count Julian, a Christian ruler from Ceuta, which is in North Africa. I think the time period of the Reconquista narrative finishes in 1492. That's when the reconquest is complete. The Jewish people, unfortunately, didn't flee. They were actually thrown out. The Muslims had a bit of a leeway for a bit longer, maybe for about another 120 years, but their life was made very difficult. Under the terms of the capitulations, the Treaty of Granada, the ruler, Muhammad XII, agreed to transfer power to to Ferdinand and Isabella on the premise that the Muslim population could keep their religion, keep their properties, and keep their wealth. Within 10 years, there'd been a lot of aggravation by the Catholic authorities to the Muslims in the Granada region, so they rebelled. Ferdinand and Isabella claimed that this rebellion was in violation of the Treaty of Granada, so they did not have to show any more religious tolerance towards the Muslims. So they were then ordered to force to convert to Catholicism en masse, which the vast majority of people did. They kept Islam in their hearts, and they practiced Islam in secret in their houses, and outwardly, in public, they appeared as Christian. But the authorities were aware of what was going on, and slowly but surely, they started clamping down. So they started banning all Arabic books, burning the Quran, banning Arabic dress, banning Arabic customs, asking people to keep their doors open, their houses on Friday, so they could come in and see what you were doing, and on days which would have been Eid as well. And as the decades went on, towards the end of the 1560s and the 1570s, the way which these rules were enforced became a lot more stricter, until eventually Muslims decided to go all out rebellion. We're going to declare our Islam openly, and we're going to fight for our existence. This was brutally put down, and eventually the order came in the early 1600s that all Moriscos, and a Morisco is a Spanish word which means little more, i.e. person who used to be Muslim, probably still is a Muslim, but Christian outwardly, has to be expelled from the Iberian Peninsula. So by 1613, the remaining Muslims were on the coast, ready to get ships to North Africa.
So a sad and brutal end to Islamic Spain there. But let's head back to my guest in the studio, Roshan Mohamed Saleh, for more on this. So, Roshan, of course, we've learned a lot today about Islamic Spain, and there's many positives that we take from that period and potentially some not so many positives as well, as we saw from the brutal way it ended. But tell me, do you think that Al-Andalus could serve as a model for a future Islamic society?
I think it's certainly a model for Muslims in Europe because of the nature of the... I mean, it was a Muslim society. It was Muslim ruled. Muslims were in charge. It was God-centered. But at the same time, minorities thrived. Christians and Jews especially thrived within that society. And I think given that in Europe and even parts of the Muslim world, we have countries which may be Muslim majority, but there are lots of minorities there as well of other religions... It does serve as a model. It serves as a model of, you know, kind of, it's a reminder of what we could achieve when we were at our best. And I do believe wholeheartedly it can be implemented today as well. And the other thing I wanted to say is that I think this whole show has been a reminder for us that Muslims, we must study our glorious Islamic history. I mean, there were several golden ages, I guess. Sunnis would say the Rashidun period was the golden age. I know Shias might have a different conception of that. Then there was the golden age under the Abbasids in Baghdad. And I think the third and perhaps the last golden age of Islamic history was Muslim Spain. The Ottomans may disagree with that, you know, but there's arguments to and fro. But I think, you know, it serves as a real iman booster for Muslims to study our history. And it wasn't all a bed of roses. We had bad kings and good kings, good rulers, bad rulers, good periods and bad periods. You know, history is human, and Islamic history is human as well. But what I always say is the bad bits come from the humans, the good bits come from Islam.
Do you think that that's a problem, though, Roshan, that perhaps we're over-glorifying these periods when, of course, you know, like you say, they weren't perfect, they weren't a utopian society?
I think we should study Islamic history in depth, not just Muslim Spain, but the Ottoman period, the Arab period, all the different periods, even Muslims as minorities in the West. And we'll find good and bad. But I sincerely believe that the good far outweighs the bad. But we shouldn't sugarcoat our history as well. We don't have to defend every aspect of history in Muslim countries, like slavery, for example. There's a lot of bad stuff that went on there. But that's not from Islam. It's from flawed human beings. And the final thing I want to say is that, you know, may the light of Islam shine in the Iberian Peninsula, in modern-day Spain and Portugal, yet again today.
Inshallah. Well, that might be an interesting question to end the show on as well. What should we be doing? Because, as you say, you're not allowed to go there and pray, for example. There's a bit of desecration going on. Like, I don't know, should Muslims do more about this? Should there be some kind of effort done to try and change the Spanish authorities' view on this? What do you think?
I think we need to raise awareness about, you know, how we're treated. I mean, I went to the mosque in Cordoba just about a month and a half ago. I did a little video saying, you know, the Christians have desecrated this place. And this is what we've lost. It's a reminder of what we've lost.
Do you think we should just go there and start praying regardless?
Well, people have done that. I mean, you'll get arrested. So, you know, I'm not encouraging people to get arrested, but Muslims have done that, and they have been arrested. And some of them, I think, been threatened with deportation or prison or something like that. Wow. I don't think anyone has been jailed, but, ridiculous. You know, they don't allow, they have security guards running around. I just think we have to raise awareness. And, of course, as Muslims, we have to give dawah, we have to invite the Spanish non-Muslims to Islam. This is what we have to do, you know, as Muslims, it's part of our duty.
It's fascinating how the emphasis is on pointing the finger at how Islam behaves and how Muslims behave, apparently spreading by the sword, when in fact we see here with the Reconquista that actually Christianity was spread by the sword in this regard. Thank you, Roshan. We have to end it there. We could talk a lot more on this. That is unfortunately all the time we have for today. But thank you to all of our guests and for you at home. Join us again next week for another edition of Eye on Islam. Salaamu Alaikum for now.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.
in the limelight.
The European Commission Chief Ursula von der Leyen is heading to Britain for final talks over the Northern Ireland Protocol. We take a look at the British media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. Reuters news agency has covered this story and tells us more. British Prime Minister Rishi Sunak met European Union Chief Ursula von der Leyen on Monday, 27th of February, in an effort to finalise a new deal for Northern Ireland's post-Brexit trading arrangements. More than a year of stop-start and sometimes rancorous negotiations between London and Brussels on an overhaul of part of the 2020 EU exit deal look to be coming to a conclusion, although it is unclear whether any agreement will go far enough to satisfy critics in both Britain and Northern Ireland. Rishi Sunak and Ursula von der Leyen agreed to continue their work in person towards shared practical solutions for the range of complex challenges around the protocol on Ireland and Northern Ireland, a joint statement issued on Sunday, 26th of February, said. President von der Leyen will therefore meet with the Prime Minister on Monday. Rishi Sunak is looking to succeed in talks where his predecessors Boris Johnson and Liz Truss failed. But the push comes at the risk of swamping his domestic priorities as he tries to overturn a large opinion poll deficit for his Conservative Party before a national election expected next year. Even if it is agreed with Brussels, the announcement of a deal is likely to be only the start. Key players in Northern Ireland have set a high bar for the kind of deal they would support, and Sunak's own Conservative Party is still riddled with divisions over Brexit that have at times paralysed British politics since the country's 2016 vote to leave the European Union. As part of its exit agreement, Britain signed an accord with Brussels known as the Northern Ireland Protocol to avoid imposing politically contentious checks along the 500-kilometre land border with EU member state Ireland. But the protocol effectively created a border for some goods moving from Britain because it kept Northern Ireland in the EU single market for goods. That has also disrupted the delicate political balance in Northern Ireland, preventing the formation of a power-sharing government set out by a 1998 peace agreement that mostly ended 3 decades of sectarian violence in the province. In an interview with the Sunday Times, Prime Minister Rishi Sunak said the shooting of a police officer in Northern Ireland last week was a reminder of the fragility of the situation in the province. Earlier on Sunday, in a round of media interviews, Deputy Prime Minister Dominic Raab said the deal would address trade tensions by easing the physical checks on goods that were demanded by the European Union under the original agreement. Dominic Raab also said the deal hoped to address concerns that the EU can set rules for Northern Ireland that cannot be influenced by the region's voters and politicians. If there are any new rules that would apply in relation to Northern Ireland, it must be right that there's a Northern Irish democratic check on that, Dominic Raab said. But Raab stopped short of saying European courts would no longer have a say in Northern Ireland. That has been a key demand of the Democratic Unionist Party, the DUP, which is currently refusing to enter a new power-sharing arrangement in Northern Ireland. The Democratic Unionist Party, DUP, has set out 7 tests for any deal. The Sunday Times said Rishi Sunak was confident the deal met those conditions, but that DUP leader Geoffrey Donaldson was minded to reject the deal. Without DUP's approval, Northern Ireland could remain without a devolved government, meaning one of the main aims of Rishi Sunak's renegotiation with the European Union has failed. The British newspaper The Guardian has also covered this story and tells us more. Rishi Sunak held a Brexit summit with the President of the European Commission on Monday, 27th of February, to sign off on a revised deal on the Northern Ireland Protocol. In what could be the most perilous week of his political life, the Prime Minister met with Ursula von der Leyen in the early afternoon of Monday for what No. 10 Downing Street billed as final talks. Rishi Sunak now faces the daunting task of selling the deal to hardline Conservative Brexiteers and Northern Ireland's Democratic Unionist Party, DUP, who issued renewed warnings over the weekend that they would not be bounced into accepting something that did not meet their red lines. While No. 10 Downing Street sources said, "There are still matters that need consideration by Sunak and von der Leyen," the meeting effectively rubber-stamped a revision of Boris Johnson's protocol for post-Brexit arrangements in Northern Ireland. The deal is not expected to radically change the way Northern Ireland trades with the European Union via the Irish border or with the rest of the United Kingdom, but will implement systems to ease checks across the Irish Sea, a feature of Boris Johnson's plan that has enraged the DUP and many Conservatives. Prime Minister Rishi Sunak also held a cabinet meeting on Monday afternoon. He's expected to update the House of Commons, where he will begin what is likely to be an extremely tough political sell. While Tory Brexiteers and the DUP have said they will only give a verdict on the revised protocol when they have read the final and full text, which might not be published until later on this week. No. 10 Downing Street is braced for a response that is at best suspicious and potentially hostile. The influential European research group of Brexit-minded Conservative MPs has warned Rishi Sunak against trying to finalise any agreement without a formal House of Commons vote, which ministers have yet to commit to. After Dominic Raab, the Deputy Prime Minister, said on Sunday that Parliament would find a way to have its say, Marc Francois, the Tory backbencher and the chair of the European Research Group, warned it would be incredibly unwise to proceed without a House of Commons vote. Marc Francois told Sky News that any continued role for EU law in Northern Ireland and thus the European Court of Justice would make the deal unacceptable, although this is inevitable given the barrier-free trade border on the island of Ireland. Marc Francois said, "Just putting in a couple of intermediate phases with a situation where you still end up with the European Court of Justice is effectively sophistry. We're not stupid. What we want is a situation where EU law is expunged altogether from Northern Ireland, so it is treated on the same basis as England, Scotland and Wales." The European Court of Justice jurisdiction in Northern Ireland would also not be acceptable to the Democratic Unionist Party, the DUP, he said, adding, "If the DUP don't consent to the deal, then it's simply not going to fly." Prime Minister Sunak is entering into a battle of the sort that brought down one of his predecessors, Theresa May, but in a different political landscape, with many Conservative MPs more amenable to compromise, aware of slumping Tory poll numbers and desperate for a political victory. While dissent from the Democratic Unionist Party would be a blow to Rishi Sunak, the Downing Street sell to Conservative MPs would be for them to think beyond ideological purity and to embrace an achievement that proved beyond Theresa May and, to an extent, Boris Johnson. This whole process has been based on trying to achieve something that is the best interest of all people in Northern Ireland and businesses there, a government source said. That is the lens through which the Prime Minister has approached these negotiations, with them in mind. Another difference is that in elections in the moribund Northern Ireland Assembly in May of last year, the Democratic Unionist Party finished second to Sinn Féin, and polling shows the protocol is a big concern to a minority of local voters. The next few days are nonetheless likely to be fraught and complex, with some Conservative MPs saying that while they're open to examining the text of a deal, they fear it might be little more than a dressed-up version of the existing protocol.
32.
Two men.
Yani?
Bazaar.
Historically, humans lived a colourful and adventurous hunter-gatherer lifestyle. But what brought humans into the valleys and grasslands, and later into a collective society? Some argue wheat domesticated mankind, settling humans permanently next to their fields. Humans have come a long way from traditional farming. Presently, some 38% of the Earth's surface is used to cultivate crops. Technology has revolutionized agricultural production, leading to more food security worldwide.
Oh, hello there. Welcome to another edition of Bazaar. This time we will explore the agriculture industry. We shine the spotlight on the marriage between technology and science for high-yield agricultural productions. We wanted to see how the agricultural sector is developing new ways to increase the efficiency of natural resource use while also elevating the quality of cultivated food. Well, let's not waste any time. Let's walk through the fields of today's bazaar.
Our quest for answers led us to a company in Khorasan Razavi province that specializes in livestock rearing and potato cultivation. Khozai is a family business handed down to four generations over the years. It has some 2,400 hectares of farmland where saffron, Mohammadi roses, potatoes and wheat are cultivated. This company has spent years perfecting a cultivation system using its own agrotechie, enabling it to enhance the performance of mini tubers. So what is a mini tuber? They are the first generation of nuclear miniature seed potatoes. These can be engineered to have disease-free characteristics and are bred to shorten field cycles, leading to high harvest yields of healthy potatoes. The beating heart of this company is its research and development department. This is where production actually begins. This company has several varieties of potatoes in vitro tissue culture form that are subject to rigorous disease testing. This ensures the company starts cultivation with the highest quality tissue cultures. After lab tests, the plant material is transferred to hydroponic greenhouses and later taken to the field for mass production.
You might be wondering why some farmers choose hydroponic methods over others. It's a soilless system where roots are kept in a dark environment saturated with an aerosol of nutrient-rich solution. This way, cultivators can observe the entire plant structure and strictly control production phases. Plus, this high-tech method gives cultivators unique insight into specific plant characteristics that can assist with field production.
As we mentioned earlier, this company also specializes in raising sheep and cows for meat and dairy production. It's interesting to know how potato production led to livestock rearing. The founder and director of the company shares his experience with us. After the mini tubes are raised in greenhouses, a portion of them is stored in refrigerated rooms for later use. Other storage facilities hold potato seeds and harvested products, which are later released into the market. It is no surprise that this company has received three consecutive national awards for being a top producer of livestock and agricultural products. Much of its success is attributed to a large amount of science and knowledge used for production. This company employs expert staff and researchers who also play a significant role in the company's dynamic progress.
36 people are
پرسنل ما دارای مدرک تحصیلی بالای کارشناسی ارشد هستند و اینها خیلی کمک ما میکنند در پویایی این مجموعه. به همین ترتیب تمام مجموعه ها افرادی رو از ابتدا شروع کرده تربیت کردن و تحصیل کردن در این مورد و تک تک افراد از ابتدا روی رشته‌های خاص خودشون کار میکردن، از قبل از دیپلمشون برای این کار تأهید شده بودن و تونستن دوره دکتراشون رو در رشته‌ای بگیرن که مورد نظر مجموعه بوده و موضوع گزارششون رو مجموعه براشون تعیین کرده که این گزارش رو این رشته رو بخونن.
As part of its future vision, this company is eyeing expansion. It is already working on launching a botany clinic and other food-related laboratories. This company takes a great deal of pride in its socially responsible productions. It has spent decades trying to optimize its use of natural resources and make organic and nutritious products.
The company we just mentioned is just one example of how the agricultural industry is expanding with the help of modern technology. Iran produces tons of agricultural products annually, which it also exports to destinations abroad. The food industry is also heavily dependent on this sector as it plays a critical role in the country's food security and national economy.
Iran has a total area of 165 million hectares of land. Of this amount, 50 million hectares are arable farmlands. Moreover, some 21,000 hectares are dedicated to greenhouse farming. Iran's agriculture makes up around 8% of the national GDP. Plus, it employs one-fifth of the country's entire workforce. The country's agro-food products also accounted for around 20% of the country's non-oil exports in 2020. Data from Iran's Customs Administration shows that Iran exported over $800 million worth of agricultural products from April through May this year. Additionally, figures showed over 1.7 million tons of these products were sold to foreign markets during that period. Around half of the revenue generated from exports belonged to 10 major agricultural products. Championing the top of the export list were pistachios. This was followed by watermelon and tomatoes in terms of export value. Horticulture, aquaculture, and livestock products also raked in millions in foreign exchange. Industry analysts say there has been a relative decline in exports compared to the same two-month period last year. They say more attention should be given to marketing, better packaging and transportation to boost agricultural exports. The Chamber of Commerce, Industries, Mines and Agriculture also released a report examining the relative decline in agricultural products. The report showed a less than average rainfall coupled with misuse of natural resources in farming practices are two of the major culprits of reduced production. Mining is the process of extracting valuable materials from the Earth's crust. It is one of the oldest industries and dates back to prehistoric times when people first mined flint to make tools and weapons. However, mining has come a long way from its traditional methods to incorporate advanced material science and geology. Moreover, modern mining wouldn't be the same without its heavy-duty machines to extract and haul material for processing. On the whole, this sector is one of the largest and most productive industries the world has ever known.
We are going to take a look at Iran's mining industry while shining the spotlight on zinc dust production. We wanted to see how this stuff is made and where it's used. Plus, we will explore this sector's contributions to the national economy.
To better understand the most recent developments in the mining industry, we visited Zarin Rui Caspian.
It is a subsidiary of the parent company Zarin Industrial Mining Group and specializes in making zinc dust. Products at this company come in the form of bluish-gray zinc powder or granules. These products are made with specific formulations depending on their end use. In short, these items are produced when purified zinc vapors are condensed. But this requires a large amount of processing, starting with melting zinc crucibles. Next, the molten zinc is transferred to a vaporizing furnace. The vapors are then sent to a condenser to form zinc dust by circulating the gas through a cyclone cooler. Most zinc dust production plants include a vertical crucible melting and vaporizing furnace and a condenser, which operate on a fluid and continuous basis. That's why this production company works around the clock without breaks. Now you might be wondering where zinc powder is used. Due to its unique characteristics, it is a sacrificing element that helps prevent corrosion, meaning it works well in absorbing moisture and strengthening metal surfaces against oxidation. It is a perfect substance for coating industrial machines that withstand harsh climatic conditions.
So many processes are at work when it comes to mining. There is exploration, extraction, and refining of raw material, just to name a few. But activities don't end there. Usually, there are mega holding companies in the mining sector with several subsidiaries, such as the company we just mentioned. These subsidiaries are essential in expanding and completing mining-based products' supply chains.
An asset to corporations is their research and development departments. This is because they carry out activities leading to technological development. That is to say, they develop new services or products and improve existing ones while elevating the company's industrial standing. This department also performs critical quality control checks where standards are also implemented. And indeed, standards are everything, especially for foreign trade. One of this company's competitive advantages is its high purity products based on national and international needs. This company also purchases most of its raw materials from domestic suppliers. Among its services, it can formulate zinc powders based on special orders from customers. It also provides its customers flexible delivery, whether by sea, air, or ground. This producer has never stopped looking to the future. It plans